This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Bellow, 20th Century History Guy.
A little over five decades ago, the Russians sent the dog into outer space. A mutt named Laika that some government functionary had found on the streets of Moscow. They suited her up in a dog spacesuit, put her on a rocket ship, and off she went.
You know, we later learned that that little dog only lasted a few hours and she probably died from stress. But back in November 1957, it seemed like most of the stress was on this side of the Bering Strait. The U.S. had been caught napping a month earlier when the Russians announced that they had launched Sputnik 1.
Today, a new moon is in the sky.
Now, they had repeated the stunt, this time with a living, breathing passenger on board, at least for a little while. What would Sputnik 3 carry? A nuclear missile?
You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite, one of the great scientific feats of the age.
It didn't take long for the pundits to figure out who was to blame for this colossal national embarrassment. The military? No. Congress? No. The White House? Uh-uh. It was America's schools who had gotten us into this mess. Russian schools were churning out scientists who could put a dog into space, and American schools were churning out, well, rock and roll.
Hail, hail, rock and roll.
As the cover of Life magazine announced the following spring, there was a crisis in education.
The Soviet Union now has, in the combined category of scientists and engineers, a greater number than the United States.
Dwight Eisenhower, November 1957.
And it is producing graduates in these fields at a much faster rate. This trend is disturbing.
It may have been disturbing, but the Sputnik episode was not the first or the last time schools were blamed for our national crises. Just think about all the politicians you've seen railing about low standards in our schools. To take a classic example, A Nation at Risk, the report commissioned by Ronald Reagan in the early 80s. To quote one of its best lines, if an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose on America the mediocre educational performance that exists today, we might well have viewed it as an act of war.
Despite record levels of educational spending, America's students came in last in 7 of 19 academic tests compared to students of other industrialized nations.
On each episode of Backstory, we rip a topic from the headlines and spend an hour exploring its historical context. Today, our topic is public education, because once again, it's taking its lumps in our nation's capital. Here's President Obama back in February.
We have one of the highest high school dropout rates of any industrialized nation, and half of the students who begin college never finish. This is a prescription for economic decline, because we know the countries that outteach us today will outcompete us tomorrow.
So have we always been worried about being out-taught? Later in the show, we're going to be speaking with a historian of education about what many think of as the golden age of education, the era of the one-room schoolhouse back in the 19th century. We'll also look at one of the darkest chapters in the 20th century history of education. But first, we're going to turn to our 18th century guy here for some deep background on all this. So, Peter,
Tell
us, did people back in your period worry that we were going to fall behind our competitors, the British or the French or whatever, because our schools weren't doing their jobs back then?
Well, this is really deep background, Ed, and the answer is no. In fact, the idea that the common people should be educated was a heresy in the old days. That is, why would you want them to be able to read and write? Because, as many early modern thinkers thought, if people were too literate, they'd be uppity. They'd claim rights or something like this. And, you know, and that's really the story of American education. It doesn't have international competition. It didn't have anything to do with that.
So how many people did go to school, Peter? I mean, you know, was it just for elites?
Well, in theory, in colonial Massachusetts, every community with a certain population was supposed to have a school, but this was a statute that was observed more in the breach. Most education as we know it today took place within homes, particularly Bible-centered homes where literacy was important in the religious life of communities. There weren't schools to do this. You could say that churches as such were a kind of educational institution, But basically, these were a place of oral performances, that is, where sermons would be delivered and texts would be read out to the congregation. So mass education as we know it is really a phenomenon of, well, Ed's century.
Well, now I can see Ed waiting for the school bus, but before we let him get on it, I just got one more question. And yes, Peter, it has to do with your guy, Jefferson. He had a few ideas on education, didn't he?
Absolutely, Brian. He is the author of a stillborn notion of universal public education. We don't like to emphasize the stillborn part. We like to say that Jefferson was a great visionary in his 1779 Bill for the Diffusion of Knowledge.
It only took another 130 years to come to pass in his native Virginia.
Yeah, well, that's right, Ed. Hey, Virginians are slow. But
he was nearsighted, you're saying.
Yeah, but his scheme of public education was that every community would support a school for girls as well as boys at the primary level. And then there'd be this kind of pyramidal selection as you moved up, where a few select boys would be sent on from primary schools to grammar schools or secondary schools, and then on to the peak of his system, the University of Virginia, or William and Mary at that time, on a scholarship. But this proposal really reflected the paranoia that Jefferson and other revolutionary leaders had about, frankly, the ignorance of the people, that if they weren't adequately educated, they could be subject to demagoguery and they could be misled. And so they had to be trained to be able to detect conspiracies against liberty within the ruling class. And one of the paradoxical things about the democratization of American education is that the people resisted this because they suspected the motives of educational reformers. They thought educational reformers were really trying to put one over on the people by taxing them to support a system of education that would primarily benefit elites.
So let me tell you about where public education came from in the form that we know it, by which I mean taxpayer-supported universal education. Like so much, frankly, I'll have to admit that it starts in New England and Massachusetts. And Peter has described what it was like in the colonial era with this kind of patchwork of homeschooling and so forth, but with an expectation, really, that the Commonwealth owed an education to people and that the whole population was uplifted by a more broadly distributed education. And so in the 1830s, Horace Mann, who as close to anyone is the parent of American education, looked around and said, you know, what we really need to do is to make this a far more coherent, forceful, state-supported system. And what Horace Mann says is, folks, by which folks I mean wealthy people, it's going to pay off if you'll pay taxes to create public schools for everybody.
So in Peter's period, Jefferson and others are arguing, well, we need an education to create citizens. But are you suggesting that Horace Mann was also saying to Americans, hey, you know, education produces productive citizens who can actually help this economy?
No, he didn't say any of that. yes, that is exactly my 20th century friend, what he said. And he actually, you know, would make pretty specific arguments to, say, big manufacturers. Look, guys, if you want workers to be disciplined, to answer bells, to be self-motivating to the extent you want them to be able to read simple instructions, education is not merely useful to the Commonwealth and creating better citizens, yada, yada, yada. It is literally going into your pocketbook. And, you know, you look back at it and you can see that that's really the only way that man was going to be able to persuade the people who paid the most taxes to pay more to educate, frankly, other people's children. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be cynical. People would like to have jobs that were regular and well-paying. And mm-hmm. industrial jobs brought something that we never had before, which was year-round, sustained, guaranteed employment that was not tied to the agricultural cycle.
And there might be another dimension to this. I wonder if immigration had something to do with the importance of education. You know, the literacy rate in Massachusetts before Horace Mann was virtually universal for men and pretty high for women as well. So it wasn't that you needed those basic skills. And of course, if you had a religious population that spent all that time at church, they had their own bells, so to speak. They had a kind of discipline. But when you had large numbers of Irish Catholic immigrants, you faced a kind of new demographic challenge. Is that an element in man's notion of public education, is to Americanize?
You know, I don't think so. As logical as that seems, part of it would be our friend chronology. and the fact that this
not
begins,
my friend, Ed.
Speak for yourself, Ed.
The fact this begins in 1837 suggests that it predated the big tide of Irish immigration that would not come for another decade,
yeah,
and that would not peak for 20 more years.
Yeah.
So I think, in fact, that if man had waited until the challenge was to spend tax money to educate a bunch of new immigrants,
it wouldn't have happened.
It wouldn't have happened. So ironically, it's just sort of a fulfillment of a sense that a homogenous America can become even more homogenous, mm-hmm, by using education.
So, Ed, what are the social changes that lead to an emphasis on education? If it's not yet widespread immigration, is it the fact that Massachusetts farm children are moving away from home because only a limited number of people could sustain farm operations through the generations? So that, in a way, there's an anxiety about the future and about what provisions are going to be made for children, and a growing recognition that new sets of skills are going to be necessary to cope with an unpredictable future.
That's beautifully put, Peter, and exactly right. And this takes us back to Sputnik, because in the same way that the Soviets led to a great period of instability and anxiety in the country, if you're sitting there in Massachusetts and you're watching a lot of your population leave, and you're wondering, you know, how it is that you're going to be able to...
How are we going to keep up?
Yeah. People are really saying, how are we going to be able to keep people in New England when you've got the Northwest open? You know, when there's land out there to be taken, what's going to keep people on the rocky soil of the Berkshires or whatever? And it's also the case that, you know, manufacturing is growing. And if you're going to, you know, sort of want to compete with the great industrial power of the time, England, you're going to have a population that knows how to invent and create. So I think it's a recurring theme from as long as we've been a nation, maybe not back in the colonial period, but it didn't take long in the 19th century for that kind of rhetoric of we're under peril and only education can really save us.
Well, in a minute, we'll delve a little deeper into that 19th century and look at why one-room schoolhouses weren't all they're cracked up to be.
This is Backstory, the show that looks to the past to explain the America of today. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th century history guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, history guy of the 20th century. Today on the show, we're exploring the history of public education. Like so many other topics we've explored on Backstory, we tend to remember that history is being much rosier than it actually was. Take, for example, the song we're listening to right now, School Days.
School days, school days, good old golden rule days, reading, writing, arithmetic, taught to the tune of a hickory stick, etc.
That's John Zimmerman, a historian of education at New York University.
Well, in 1949, the New York Times declared this one of the 10 most popular songs in the history of the United States.
School Days is all about a one-room schoolhouse in Ed's period, the 19th century. But it was written in the first decade of my century by a guy named Gus Edwards.
Now, what's interesting about School Days is as follows. Gus Edwards was a German immigrant who moved to Brooklyn when he was 7. He never, as best we know, stepped into a one-room schoolhouse, and he might not really have left New York. Actually, he did. He eventually went to L.A.
Uh-huh.
But Gus Edwards was a vaudevillian and later became a booking agent. This is the guy who wrote our most popular and our most influential ode to the one-room schoolhouse, and he's an urban immigrant from Germany.
part of the reason John Zimmerman is so fired up about this subject is that he's just written a book about it. It's called Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. In it, he looks at the way school reformers with a wide range of agendas invoke the one-room schoolhouse as a kind of model educational setting. In fact, until recently, there was an actual model of a Little Red Schoolhouse outside the entrance of the Department of Education in Washington. Zimmerman basically argues that this nostalgia, a word he likes to point out, comes from the Greek for homesickness, that this nostalgia skews all kinds of facts about Little Red Schoolhouses, beginning with their color.
Most one-room schoolhouses were either white or more commonly just unpainted because school districts didn't want to pay to paint them.
Help me understand this, John. Americans seem to put education, public education, on a pedestal. But, you know, we don't want to pay to paint the little schoolhouse.
I think that's true. And I think that that contradiction goes back all the way to the founding of the common schools. The common school movement, the idea that there should be universal state-supported education, was, although not unique to the United States, in many ways distinct to it. By 1850, there are a greater fraction of elementary school-age kids going to school in our country than on any country on earth. But what we did in the 19th century was we sent an extraordinarily large fraction, relatively speaking, of our kids to school. And we sent them to school in essentially shacks. That's what one-room schoolhouses were. They were 15 by 40 feet in dimension, and they were in every sense bare bones. Mm-hmm. Most of them did not even have a belfry or bell, even though we remember that part too. Very primitive heating systems, if any at all. You read accounts of people trying to drink water in a one-room schoolhouse, but finding out that the water they had brought in earlier in the day was frozen, was ice. The teaching force, which is overwhelmingly single female and young, and young means sometimes as young as 15 or 16.
Wow.
Often has very, very little more education than the kids they're teaching.
Yeah.
If you think about Little House on the Prairie, right? This was
my
Laura Ingalls Wilder.
My touchstone for all things historical.
Exactly. Exactly. Laura Ingalls Wilder, of course, this was an autobiographical story, and it was about her life on the prairie in the 1880s. It didn't become popular until the 1930s, which was precisely the time when, thanks to the WPA and the PWA, they're ripping down these one-room
right.
schools. And that's important too, right? Because this again becomes a venue for nostalgia, for remembering an institution that's going away.
Right.
But what does she remember in those stories? I mean, she remembers being a kid teaching other kids.
Yes.
And she remembers all kinds of problems with the so-called big boys, right? Because you might guess the big boys are the ones that are going to test your authority.
And John, what is roughly the age range?
Age 3 to 20.
Age 20.
3 to 20.
Wow.
And often all in the same place. And sometimes there would be as many as 100 kids in a 15 by 40 square box, and sometimes there would be as few as 4. The major deficiency is that the pedagogy is entirely what we would call rote.
Yeah.
And rote means repeat. And it has to be. It has to be not just because of the lack of training of the teacher, but also because of the enormous age range of kids.
Yeah.
So they all have their own primers, and people would bring in whatever textbook they had. And what they would do is they would memorize it and then recite it in a rotating way to the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not uncommon to find 11 or 12-year-old kids that could just say a whole textbook.
Wow. But was there some basis for the later nostalgia of this homesickness, as you put it?
If the question is there a reason for people to look back longingly on these? There absolutely is. And here's the reason. Whatever their deficiencies, they were communal institutions.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, they were the only public building. So they were not just a place where the kids went to school. They were a place where the community met. If it's the only public building, it's not just a schoolhouse, right? It's the place where voting happens,
right?
Right? Where debates happen. Not just that. Weddings, funerals, all of the holidays, you know, Christmas, Easter. And so they were not perfect. They had a multitude of deficiencies. But when people look back at them and say, but they were ours, this is absolutely true.
Am I being really naive and nostalgic, to use your word, to think that there was something good about getting literally everybody in the community, kids, adults, etc., all in one room and just letting them hash it out. I mean, contrast that image, at any rate, to what we have today, this long chain of bureaucratic commands stretching all the way from the Secretary of Education down to the assistant principal for physical education and discipline.
Well, here's the thing. I think you have to go back to answer the question to distinguish between what adults were doing in these schools and what kids were doing. The one-room schools of the 19th century were profoundly small-d democratic and debate-filled institutions in the evening, right?
Yes.
When the entire community showed up to debate, among other things,
whether to pay for the school. Yeah.
Exactly. You don't have to be a nostalgist to celebrate the idea that there were these public institutions that brought everybody together to debate the content and the contours of their shared lives.
Yeah.
However, let's not impute that dynamic to the classroom itself when the kids and teachers were in there, because that was not a land of democratic debate.
That was the three R's, rote, rote, and rote.
Completely. Uh-huh. My way or the highway. and that's why teachers devised all of these, to us, draconian punishments. By the way, the dunce cap was rarely used, but every other kind of humiliation was, often recapitulating the alleged error or sin. So a kid that talked too much would have a twig affixed to their tongue. A kid who chewed gum would have the gum put on their forehead or their nose. And to me, the most fascinating one, which tells you a lot about the 19th century, is that a kid who was a poor speller would have to cut letters out of a newspaper and eat them. And this sounds quite barbaric, and in many ways it is.
Is that where Eat Your Words comes from, by the way?
It may be. I mean, we don't know. But something that I find fascinating about this is, on one level, it's awful, horrible, humiliating, gross, right? But I think it's also an example of a time when any academic failure was considered to be a function of a lack of effort, right?
Yes.
Not differential ability, right? That punishment is pre-IQ test, right?
Right.
And it's pre the entire concept of disability.
Yes.
If you're not spelling, it's not because you have a different learning style that prevents you from spelling.
Right.
It's because you weren't listening. So eat some words. Here's your punishment. So as awful as it is, I think there's also something that in some ways I find rather salutary about it. There is something quite small democratic about the idea that everyone has the same ability.
Right.
Ergo, if they're doing worse, it's because they didn't apply themselves.
Right. There's a presumption that there's an equal starting ground there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, John, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
John Zimmerman directs the History of Education program at New York University's Steinhardt School of Education. His new book is Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. You can listen to an extended version of our conversation at backstoryradio.org.
Come on, children, you're acting like children. Every generation thinks it's the end of the world.
Well, guys, you noticed I took advantage of being alone with our guest to conflate all kinds of things, and I was just anticipating you now pulling them apart. And, you know, maybe we want to start with you, Ed. What do you think about what John said, and does it have any application to all of those schools that you've studied in the South?
You know, it takes a lot of fun out of it, Brian, when you just sort of, you know, roll over on your back like that. But, you know, actually, it was a great interview. And I think in many ways it captures what the experience of the 20th century South was like. The South, as we know, is a little bit behind the times when it comes to education. It just simply wasn't the same kind of value placed on it. All the way from the 18th century on, the elite was actually pretty well educated, and they went to a lot of trouble to create academies and colleges and boarding schools and tutors and all those kinds of things. But if you go back to the 19th century South, there were no mechanisms for middle and lower class people to gain an education. And if you were African American, of course, it was illegal to learn how to read. So not only were there not schools, but there were laws that prohibited you from gaining literacy. So the idea coming along of a school for everybody was a late innovation and progress.
So guys, this may be naive, but you know, at least one good thing about this notion of a common schoolhouse is it does strike me as a place where at least everybody could come together.
Well, they come together, Brian, but not necessarily on everybody's terms. I mean, if you think about early public education in New England and Massachusetts particularly, where the King James Bible is a text, in effect. I mean, it's a Protestant education. And that was one of the reasons why many Catholics, one of the many reasons why they wanted their own schools.
Yeah.
Yeah, and no sooner do you start having public schools in New England than Catholic schools start growing up. And you have some of the biggest debates and riots around parochial schools in the North in the 1840s and 1850s, because people say, I don't want the state educating my children into Protestantism, and I don't want them to be using books and Bibles that are prejudiced against my religion. And the people who, on the other side, well, we don't want Catholics gathering together outside of the common vocabulary and teaching about popery or whatever.
Hey, guys, I never said they sang Kumbaya together. I just said they came together to hash out some of these fundamental issues that, you know, are at the heart of our Democratic Republic.
Well, but Brian, these are not level playing fields. I mean, we have a notion of state neutrality, which I think we, to an extraordinary extent, live by in modern day America. But it's been a tough slog, and you can't take it for granted. And even today, you have to wonder, what are the implicit messages? This is what's being asked when people challenge the nature of education and the role of religion in education. What's being taught in schools?
Yeah, well, I think it's time for some explicit messages, which is why we're going to turn to our listeners. As we do every episode of Backstory, we've been fielding your comments on today's topic on our website, backstoryradio.org. We've gotten a lot of great comments there, and our producers have invited a few of you to join us on the phone today.
We got Kathleen on the line from New York City. Kathleen, welcome to Backstory.
Hi. I've got a question for you guys.
Let's hear it, Kathleen.
These days, I hear a lot of complaints from my daughter about school. You know, it's too long, there's too much homework. And I was wondering, what did children in the 19th century think about school?
Wow.
The reason I asked it is both my grandmothers, who were born in the 1880s, they loved school. They thought it was like, oh, it's so great, you know, I can get away from doing chores. And So what are the evidence, what kind of sources have you got, and what do the kids of the 19th century say?
You know, what's interesting is how much this changed over the 19th century. At the beginning of the 19th century, they wouldn't think about school all that much because they didn't really go all that much. I think you would have seen that kids would not have complained about how long school went, but rather would have been struck by how sporadic it was and how short the day was and how little attention each individual student received because they were all together in, you know, one big classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I just want to say to 18th and 19th century guys that kids didn't really start going to school until the 20th century.
That's right.
Even as late as 1900, half the kids in the United States didn't go to school. And the average number of years that people went to school was about 5 years.
Okay, so Brian, when would you say school began to present something like a total environment for children, and they'd expect to go through it, and they would see it as a fact of life, one that they didn't necessarily like very much?
I would say, Peter, if you're talking about northern urban schools, I would say by the 1920s, school is kind of a regular experience for most kids. Now, we're not talking about high school, but we are talking about regular schooling, at least through what we would call middle school age years. And one of the reasons for that was compulsory education laws. And more states started imposing them, beginning in the Progressive Era. But you know when they really took effect was during the Great Depression. And why do you think that was, Kathleen?
Keeping teachers employed.
Keeping teachers employed, but also keeping kids out of the workforce, right? With so few jobs to go around, all kinds of measures were taken in order to preserve those jobs for adults. But that's really, I would say, somewhere between the 20s and the 30s. That's when kids started complaining about school the most because they were in school the most.
I will say, having read quite a few letters and diaries and stuff from the 19th century, you don't have to go very far to find people complaining about, oh my God, I'm going to shoot myself if I have to sit here and, you know, read this Latin, you know, one more night. So I think, you know, that the point that I would make is it depends on everything else in which the education is embedded. If the contrast is, you know, shoveling out barns, school looks pretty good. So as we've ratcheted up the expectations of schooling, we've ratcheted down the expectations of everything else. And so kids' entire, you know, experience of being young is now channeled and focused on school. And so we invest it with a lot more significance than it used to have, including a lot more complaint about boredom and so forth.
Do you agree, Kathleen? Are you actually interested in this?
I am very interested in it. I went to a New England school that had 6 grades in 4 rooms.
Wow.
And, you know, part
of... How did that work? Could you tell us more specifically how that worked?
Well, the teacher didn't pay attention to you all the time because sometimes she was working with the other kids. So basically, you could spend your whole life, you know, either daydreaming or reading, as in my case, and they wouldn't necessarily know what was going on. So,
Kathleen, you're saying you learned more because the teacher didn't pay attention to you and you actually could read?
Yes.
Okay, here's a radical reform proposal.
I like that. I like that very much.
Hey, Kathleen, thanks for that great call.
Thank you.
Thanks,
it's
Kathleen.
Really fascinating.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for another short break. Remember, we want to hear your stories about your own education. Did school facilitate your education, or did it just get in the way? What do you think our schools today can learn from the lessons of the past?
Leave your comments and questions at backstoryradio.org, or just give us a call. Our phone number is 888-257-8851.
After the break, we'll take more of your calls, and we'll speak with a Virginia woman who experienced school segregation up close and personal. We'll be back.